tired. Nearly two decades ago, Garza had been ushered into this imposing chamber, where he had been interviewed, cross-examined, and interrogated, before finally being offered the job of head of the Royal Guard. Now Garza's own agents had arrested him. "I'm being charged with plotting an assassination? And for framing the bishop?" The logic behind the allegations was so twisted that Garza couldn't begin to untangle it. When it came to the Royal Guard, Garza was the highest-ranking official in the palace, meaning the order to arrest him could have come from only one man, Prince Julian himself. "Valdespino poisoned the prince's mind against me," Garza realized. The bishop had always been a political survivor, and tonight he was apparently desperate enough to attempt this audacious media stunt, a bold ploy to clear his own reputation by smearing Garza's. "And now they've locked me in the armory so I can't speak for myself." If Julian and Valdespino had joined forces, Garza knew he was lost, entirely outmaneuvered. At this point, the only person on earth with power enough to help Garza was an old man who was living out his final days in a hospital bed in his private residence at Palacio de la Zarzuela, the King of Spain. "Then again," Garza realized, "the king will never help me if doing so means crossing Bishop Valdespino or his own son." He could hear the crowds outside chanting louder now, and it sounded like things might take a violent turn. When Garza realized what they were chanting, he couldn't believe his ears. "Where does Spain come from?" they shouted. "Where is Spain going?" The protesters, it appeared, had seized upon Kirsch's two provocative questions as an opportunity to rant about the political future of Spain's monarchy. "Where do we come from? Where are we going?" Condemning the oppression of the past, Spain's younger generation was constantly calling for faster change, urging their country to join the civilized world as a full democracy and to abolish its monarchy. France, Germany, Russia, Austria, Poland, and more than 50 other countries had abandoned their crowns in the last century. Even in England, there was a push for a referendum on ending the monarchy after the current queen died. Tonight, unfortunately, Madrid's royal palace was in a state of disarray, so it was not surprising to hear this age-old battle cry being raised again. "Just what Prince Julian needs," Garza thought, as he prepares for ascension to the throne. The door at the far end of the armory suddenly clicked open, and one of Garza's Guardia agents peered in. Garza shouted to him,
"I want an attorney! And I want a statement for the press,"
the familiar voice of Monica Martin shouted back as the palace's PR coordinator maneuvered around the guard and marched into the room.
"Commander Garza, why did you collude with the killers of Edmund Kirsch?"
Garza stared at her in disbelief. "Has everyone gone mad?"
"We know you framed Bishop Valdespino," Martin declared, striding toward him. "And the palace wants to publish your confession right now."
The commander had no reply. Halfway across the room, Martin spun around abruptly, glaring back at the young guard in the doorway.
"I said a private confession."
The guard looked uncertain as he stepped back and closed the door. Martin wheeled back toward Garza and stormed the rest of the way across the floor.
"I want a confession now," she bellowed,
her voice echoing off the vaulted ceiling as she arrived directly in front of him.
"Well, you won't get one from me," Garza replied evenly. "I have nothing to do with this. Your allegations are completely untrue."
Martin glanced nervously over her shoulder. Then she stepped closer, whispering in Garza's ear.
"I know. I need you to listen to me very carefully."
Chapter 68. Trending up 2,747%. ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news of antipopes, bleeding palms, and eyes sewn shut. Strange Tales from Within the Palmerian Church. Posts from online Christian news groups have now confirmed that Admiral Luis Avila is an active member of the Palmerian Church and has been one for several years. Serving as a celebrity advocate for the church, Navy Admiral Luis Avila has repeatedly credited the Palmerian Pope with saving his life following a deep depression over the loss of his family in an anti-Christian terrorist attack. Because it is the policy of Conspiracy Net never to support or condemn religious institutions, we have posted dozens of outside links to the Palmerian Church. Here. We inform, you decide. Please note, many of the online claims regarding the Palmerians are quite shocking, and so we are now asking for help from you, our users, to sort fact from fiction. The following facts were sent to us by star informant monteatiglesia.org, whose perfect track record tonight suggests that these facts are true, and yet before we report them as such, we are hoping some of our users can offer additional hard evidence either to support or refute them. Facts. Palmerian Pope Clemente lost both eyeballs in a car accident in 1976 and continued to preach for a decade with his eyes sewn shut. Pope Clemente had active stigmata on both palms that regularly bled when he had visions. Several Palmerian popes were officers of the Spanish military with strong Carlist ideals. Palmerian church members are forbidden from speaking to their own families, and several members have died on the compound from malnutrition or abuse. Palmerians are banned from 1. Reading books authored by non-Palmerians, 2. Attending family weddings or funerals unless their families are Palmerians, 3. Attending pools, beaches, boxing matches, dance halls, or any location displaying a Christmas tree or image of Santa Claus. Palmerians believe the Antichrist was born in the year 2000. Palmerian recruitment houses exist in the USA, Canada, Germany, Austria, and Ireland. Chapter 69. As Langdon and Ambra followed Father Benya toward the colossal bronze doors of Sagrada Familia, Langdon found himself marveling, as he always did, over the utterly bizarre details of this church's main entrance. "It's a wall of codes," he mused, eyeing the raised typography that dominated the monolithic slabs of burnished metal. Protruding from the surface were more than 8,000 three-dimensional letters embossed in bronze. The letters ran in horizontal lines, creating a massive field of text with virtually no separation between the words. Although Langdon knew the text was a description of Christ's passion written in Catalan, its appearance was closer to that of an NSA encryption key. No wonder this place inspires conspiracy theories. Langdon's gaze moved upward, climbing the looming passion facade, where a haunting collection of gaunt, angular sculptures by the artist Josep Maria Subirax stared down, dominated by a horribly emaciated Jesus dangling from a crucifix that had been canted steeply forward, giving the frightening effect that it was about to topple down onto the arriving guests. To Langdon's left, another grim sculpture depicted Judas betraying Jesus with a kiss. This effigy, rather strangely, was flanked by a carved grid of numbers, a mathematical magic square. Edmund had once told Langdon that this square's magic constant of 33 was in fact a hidden tribute to the Freemasons' pagan reverence for the great architect of the universe, an all-encompassing deity whose secrets were allegedly revealed to those who reached the Brotherhood's 33rd degree. "A fun story," Langdon had replied with a laugh, "but Jesus being age 33 at the time of the Passion is a more likely explanation." As they neared the entrance, Langdon winced to see the church's most gruesome embellishment, a colossal statue of Jesus, scourged and bound to a pillar with ropes. He quickly shifted his gaze to the inscription above the doors. Two Greek letters, Alpha and Omega.
Beginning and end, Ambra whispered, also eyeing the letters. Very Edmond.
Langdon nodded, catching her meaning. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Father Benya opened a small portal in the wall of bronze letters, and the entire group entered, including the two Guardia agents. Benya closed the door behind them. Silence. Shadows. There in the southeast end of the transept, Father Benya shared with them a startling story. He recounted how Kirsch had come to him and offered to make a huge donation to Sagrada Familia in return for the church agreeing to display his copy of Blake's illuminated manuscripts in the crypt near Gaudí's tomb. In the very heart of this church, Langdon thought, his curiosity piqued.
Did Edmond say why he wanted you to do this? Ambra asked.
Benya nodded.
He told me that his lifelong passion for Gaudí's art had come from his late mother, who had also been a great admirer of the work of William Blake. Mr. Kirsch said he wanted to place the Blake volume near Gaudí's tomb as a tribute to his late mother. It seemed to me there was no harm.
Edmond never mentioned his mother liking Gaudí, Langdon thought, puzzled. Moreover, Paloma Kirsch had died in a convent, and it seemed unlikely that a Spanish nun would admire a heterodox British poet. The entire story seemed like a stretch.
Also, Benya continued, I sensed Mr. Kirsch might have been in the throes of a spiritual crisis, and perhaps had some health issues as well.
The notation on the back of this title card, Langdon interjected, holding it up, says that the Blake book must be displayed in a particular way, lying open to page 163.
Yes, that's correct.
Langdon felt his pulse quicken. Can you tell me which poem is on that page?
Benya shook his head.
There is no poem on that page.
I'm sorry?
The book is Blake's complete works, his artwork and writings. Page 163 is an illustration.
Langdon shot an uneasy glance at Ambra. We need a 47-letter line of poetry, not an illustration.
Father, Ambra said to Benya, would it be possible for us to see it right away?
The priest wavered an instant, but apparently thought better of refusing the future queen.
The crypt is this way,
he said, leading them down the transept toward the center of the church. The two Guardia agents followed behind.
I must admit, Benya said, I was hesitant to accept money from so outspoken an atheist. But his request to display his mother's favorite Blake illustration seemed harmless to me, especially considering it was an image of God.
Langdon thought he had misheard. Did you say Edmund asked you to display an image of God?
Benya nodded. I sensed he was ill, and that perhaps this was his way of trying to make amends for a life of opposition to the divine.
He paused, shaking his head.
Although after seeing his presentation tonight, I must admit, I don't know what to think.
Langdon tried to imagine which of Blake's countless illustrations of God Edmund might have wanted displayed. As they all moved into the main sanctuary, Langdon felt as if he were seeing this space for the very first time. Despite having visited Sagrada Familia many times in various stages of its construction, he had always come during the day, when the Spanish sun poured through the stained glass, creating dazzling bursts of color and drawing the eye upward, ever upward, into a seemingly weightless canopy of vaults. At night, this is a heavier world. The basilica's sun-dappled forest of trees was gone, transformed into a midnight jungle of shadows and darkness, a gloomy stand of striated columns stretching skyward into an ominous void.
Watch your step, the priest said. We save money where we can.
Lighting these massive European churches, Langdon knew, cost a small fortune, and yet the sparse utility lighting here barely illuminated the way, one of the challenges of a 60,000-square-foot floor plan. As they reached the central nave and turned left, Langdon gazed at the elevated ceremonial platform ahead. The altar was an ultra-modern minimalistic table framed by two glistening clusters of organ pipes. 15 feet above the altar hung the church's extraordinary baldachin, a suspended cloth ceiling or canopy of state, a symbol of reverence inspired by the ceremonial canopies once held up on poles to provide shade for kings. Most baldachins were now solid architectural features. But Sagrada Familia had opted for cloth, in this case an umbrella-shaped canopy that seemed to hover magically in the air above the altar. Beneath the cloth, suspended by wires like a paratrooper, was the figure of Jesus on the cross. Parachuting Jesus, Langdon had heard it called. Seeing it again, he was not surprised it had become one of the church's most controversial details. As Benya guided them into increasing darkness, Langdon was having trouble seeing anything at all. Diaz pulled out a penlight and lit the tile floor beneath everyone's feet. Pressing on toward the crypt entrance, Langdon now perceived above him the pale silhouette of a towering cylinder that climbed hundreds of feet up the interior wall of the church. The infamous Sagrada Spiral, he realized, having never dared ascend it. Sagrada Familia's dizzying shaft of circling stairs had appeared on National Geographic's list of the 20 deadliest staircases in the world, earning a spot as number 3. Just behind the precarious steps up the Angkor Wat Temple in Cambodia and the mossy cliffside stones of the Devil's Cauldron Waterfall in Ecuador. Langdon eyed the first few steps of the staircase, which corkscrewed upward and disappeared into blackness. "The crypt entrance is just ahead," Benya said, motioning past the stairs toward a darkened void to the left of the altar. As they pressed onward, Langdon spotted a faint golden glow that seemed to emanate from a hole in the floor. The crypt. The group arrived at the mouth of an elegant, gently curving staircase.
"Gentlemen," Ambra said to her guards, "both of you stay here. We'll be back up shortly."
Fonseca looked displeased but said nothing. Then Ambra, Father Benya, and Langdon began their descent toward the light. Agent Diaz felt grateful for the moment of peace as he watched the three figures disappear down the winding staircase. The growing tension between Ambra Vidal and Agent Fonseca was becoming worrisome. Guardia agents are not accustomed to threats of dismissal from those they protect, only from Commander Garza. Diaz still felt baffled by Garza's arrest. Strangely, Fonseca had declined to share with him precisely who had issued the arrest order or initiated the false kidnapping story.
"The situation is complex," Fonseca had said, "and for your own protection, it's better you don't know."
So who was issuing orders? Diaz wondered. Was it the prince? It seemed doubtful that Julian would risk Umbra's safety by spreading a bogus kidnapping story. Was it Valdespina? Diaz wasn't sure if the bishop had that kind of leverage.
"I'll be back shortly," Fonseca grunted, and headed off, saying he needed to find a restroom.
As Fonseca slipped into the darkness, Diaz saw him take out his phone, place a call, and commence a quiet conversation. Diaz waited alone in the abyss of the sanctuary, feeling less and less comfortable with Fonseca's secretive behavior. Chapter 70. The staircase to the crypt spiraled down 3 stories into the earth, bending in a wide and graceful arc before depositing Langdon, Ambra, and Father Benya in the subterranean chamber. "One of Europe's largest crypts," Langdon thought, admiring the vast circular space. Exactly as he recalled, Sagrada Familia's underground mausoleum had a soaring rotunda and housed pews for hundreds of worshippers. Golden oil lanterns, placed at intervals around the circumference of the room, illuminated an inlaid mosaic floor of twisting vines, roots, branches, leaves, and other imagery from nature. A crypt was literally a hidden space, and Langdon found it nearly inconceivable that Gaudí had successfully concealed a room this large beneath the church. This was nothing like Gaudí's playful leaning crypt in Colonia Güey. This space was an austere, neo-Gothic chamber with leafed columns, pointed arches, and embellished vaults. The air was deathly still and smelled faintly of incense. At the foot of the stairs, a deep recess stretched to the left, its pale sandstone floor supported an unassuming gray slab, laid horizontally, surrounded by lanterns. The man himself, Langdon realized, reading the inscription. Antonius Gaudí. As Langdon scanned Gaudí's place of rest, he again felt the sharp loss of Edmund. He raised his eyes to the statue of the Virgin Mary above the tomb, whose plinth bore an unfamiliar symbol. What in the world? Langdon eyed the strange icon. Rarely did Langdon see a symbol he could not identify. In this case, the symbol was the Greek letter lambda, resembling an inverted Y, which in his experience did not occur in Christian symbolism. The lambda was a scientific symbol, common in the fields of evolution, particle physics, and cosmology. Stranger still, sprouting upward out of the top of this particular lambda, was a Christian cross. Religion supported by science? Langdon had never seen anything quite like it.
Puzzled by the symbol? Benya inquired, arriving beside Langdon. You're not alone. Many ask about it. It's nothing more than a uniquely modernist interpretation of a cross on a mountaintop.
Langdon inched forward, now seeing three faint gilded stars accompanying the symbol. One star was on each side of the Y, the third, at the bottom, was nestled in between the inverted Y's spokes. Three stars in that position, Langdon thought, recognizing it at once. The cross atop Mount Carmel. It's a Carmelite cross.
Correct. Gaudí's body lies beneath the Blessed Virgin Mary of Mount Carmel.
Was Gaudí a Carmelite? Langdon found it hard to imagine the modernist architect adhering to the 12th century Brotherhood's strict interpretation of Catholicism.
Most certainly not, Benya replied with a laugh. But his caregivers were. A group of Carmelite nuns lived with Gaudí and tended to him during his final years. They believed he would appreciate being watched over in death as well, and they made the generous gift of this chapel.
Thoughtful, Langdon said, chiding himself for misinterpreting such an innocent symbol. Apparently, all the conspiracy theories circulating tonight had caused even Langdon to start conjuring phantoms out of thin air.
"Is that Edmund's book?" Amber declared suddenly.
Both men turned to see her motioning into the shadows to the right of Gaudí's tomb.
"Yes," Benya replied. "I'm sorry the light is so poor."
Umbra hurried toward a display case, and Langdon followed, seeing that the book had been relegated to a dark region of the crypt, shaded by a massive pillar to the right of Gaudí's tomb.
"We normally display informational pamphlets there," Benya said, "but I moved them elsewhere to make room for Mr. Kirsch's book. Nobody seems to have noticed."
Langdon quickly joined Umbra at a hutch-like case that had a slanted glass top. Inside, propped open to page 163, barely visible in the dim light, sat a massive bound edition of the complete works of William Blake. As Benya had informed them, the page in question was not a poem at all, but rather a Blake illustration. Langdon had wondered which of Blake's images of God to expect, but it most certainly was not this one. The Ancient of Days, Langdon thought, squinting through the darkness at Blake's famous 1794 watercolor etching. Langdon was surprised that Father Baigne had called this an image of God. Admittedly, the illustration appeared to depict the archetypal Christian God, a bearded, wizened old man with white hair perched in the clouds and reaching down from the heavens. And yet a bit of research on Baigne's part would have revealed something quite different. The figure was not, in fact, the Christian God, but rather a deity called Urizen, a god conjured from Blake's own visionary imagination, depicted here measuring the heavens with a huge geometer's compass, paying homage to the scientific laws of the universe. The piece was so futuristic in style that, centuries later, the renowned physicist and atheist Stephen Hawking had selected it as the jacket art for his book, God Created the Integers. In addition, Blake's timeless demiurge watched over New York City's Rockefeller Center, where the ancient geometer gazed down from an Art Deco sculpture titled Wisdom, Light, and Sound. Langdon eyed the Blake book, again wondering why Edmund had gone to such lengths to have it displayed here. Was it pure vindictiveness? A slap in the face to the Christian Church? Edmund's war against religion never wanes, Langdon thought, glancing at Blake's Urizen. Wealth had given Edmund the ability to do whatever he pleased in life, even if it meant displaying blasphemous art in the heart of a Christian church. Anger and spite, Langdon thought. Maybe it's just that simple. Edmund, whether fairly or not, had always blamed his mother's death on organized religion. Of course, I am fully aware, Baigne said, that this painting is not the Christian God. Langdon turned to the old priest in surprise. Oh?
Yes, Edmund was quite upfront about it, although he didn't need to be. I'm familiar with Blake's ideas.
And yet you have no problem displaying the book?
Professor, the priest whispered, smiling softly, this is Sagrada Familia. Within these walls, Gaudí blended God, science, and nature. The theme of this painting is nothing new to us.
His eyes twinkled cryptically.
Not all of our clergy are as progressive as I am, but as you know, for all of us, Christianity remains a work in progress.
He smiled gently, nodding back to the book.
I'm just glad Mr. Kirsch agreed not to display his title card with the book. Considering his reputation, I'm not sure how I would have explained that, especially after his presentation tonight.
Baigne paused, his face somber.
Do I sense, however, that this image is not what you had hoped to find?
You're right. We're looking for a line of Blake's poetry.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright, Baigne offered, in the forests of the night.
Langdon smiled, impressed that Baigne knew the first line of Blake's most famous poem, a six-stanza religious query that asked if the same God who had designed the fearsome tiger had also designed the docile lamb.
Father Baigne?
Ambra asked, crouching down and peering intently through the glass.
Do you happen to have a phone or a flashlight with you?
No, I'm sorry. Shall I borrow a lantern from Antoni's tomb?
Would you please?
Ambra asked.
That would be helpful.
Baigne hurried off. The instant he left, she whispered urgently to Langdon.
Robert, Edmund didn't choose page 163 because of the painting.
What do you mean? There's nothing else on page 163.
It's a clever decoy.
You've lost me, Langdon said, eyeing the painting.
Edmund chose page 163 because it's impossible to display that page without simultaneously displaying the page next to it. Page 162.
Langdon shifted his gaze to the left, examining the folio preceding the Ancient of Days. In the dim light, he could not make out much on the page except that it appeared to consist entirely of tiny, handwritten text. Baigne returned with a lantern and handed it to Ambra, who held it up over the book. As the soft glow spread out across the open tome, Langdon drew a startled breath. The facing page was indeed text, handwritten, as were all of Blake's original manuscripts. Its margins embellished with drawings, frames, and various figures. Most significantly, however, the text on the page appeared to be designed in elegant stanzas of poetry. Directly overhead in the main sanctuary, Agent Diaz paced in the darkness, wondering where his partner was. Fonseca should have returned by now. When the phone in his pocket began vibrating, he thought it was probably Fonseca calling him, but when he checked the caller ID, Diaz saw a name he had never expected to see, Monica Martin. He could not imagine what the PR coordinator wanted, but whatever it was, she should be calling Fonseca directly. He is lead agent on this team. Hello, he answered. This is Diaz.
Agent Diaz, this is Monica Martin. I have someone here who needs to speak to you.
A moment later, a strong, familiar voice came on the line.
Agent Diaz, this is Commander Garza. Please assure me that Ms. Vidal is safe.
Yes, Commander, Diaz blurted, feeling himself bolt to attention at the sound of Garza's voice.
Ms. Vidal is perfectly safe. Agent Fonseca and I are currently with her, and safely situated inside, not on an open phone line, Garza interrupted forcefully. If she is in a safe location, keep her there. Don't move. I'm relieved to hear your voice. We tried to phone Agent Fonseca, but there was no answer. Is he with you?
Yes, sir. He stepped away to make a call, but should return.
I don't have time to wait. I'm being detained at the moment, and Ms. Martin has loaned me her phone. Listen to me very carefully. The kidnapping story, as you were no doubt aware, was wholly false. It put Ms. Vidal at great risk.
You have no idea, Diaz thought, recalling the chaotic scene on the roof of Casa Milan.
Equally untrue is the report that I framed Bishop Valdespino.
I had imagined as much, sir, but Ms. Martin and I are trying to figure out how best to manage this situation, but until we do, you need to keep the future queen out of the public eye. Is that clear?
Of course, sir, but who issued the order?
I cannot tell you that over the phone. Just do as I ask and keep Umbra Vidal away from the media and away from danger. Ms. Martin will keep you apprised of further developments.
Garza hung up, and Diaz stood alone in the darkness, trying to make sense of the call. As he reached inside his blazer to slide the phone back into his pocket, he heard a rustle of fabric behind him. As he turned, two pale hands emerged from the blackness and clamped down hard on Diaz's head. With blinding speed, the hands wrenched hard to one side. Diaz felt his neck snap and a searing heat erupt inside his skull. Then, all went black. Chapter 71 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News. New hope for Kirsch bombshell discovery. Madrid Palace PR coordinator Monica Martin made an official statement earlier claiming that Spain's queen-to-be, Umbra Vidal, was kidnapped and is being held captive by American professor Robert Langdon. The palace urged local authorities to get involved and find the queen. Civilian watchdog monte@iglesia.org has just sent us the following statement. Palace's kidnapping allegation 100% bogus. A ploy to use local police to stop Langdon from achieving his goal in Barcelona. Langdon, Vidal, believe they can still find way to trigger worldwide release of Kirsch discovery. If they succeed, Kirsch presentation could go live at any moment. Stay tuned. Incredible. And you heard it here first. Langdon and Vidal are on the run because they want to finish what Edmund Kirsch started. The palace appears desperate to stop them. Valdespino again? And where is the prince in all of this? More news as we have it, but stay tuned because Kirsch's secrets might still be revealed tonight. Chapter 72 Prince Julian gazed out of the acolyte's opal sedan at the passing countryside and tried to make sense of the bishop's strange behavior. Valdespino is hiding something. It had been over an hour since the bishop had covertly ushered Julian out of the palace, a highly irregular action, assuring him it was for his own safety. He asked me not to question, only to trust. The bishop had always been like an uncle to him and a trusted confidant of Julian's father, but Valdespino's proposal of hiding out in the prince's summer house had sounded dubious to Julian from the start. Something is off. I'm being isolated. No phone, no security, no news, and nobody knows where I am. Now, as the car bumped over the railroad tracks near Casita del Principe, Julian gazed down the wooded road before them. 100 yards ahead on the left loomed the mouth of the long, tree-lined driveway that led to the remote cottage retreat. As Julian pictured the deserted residence, he felt a sudden instinct for caution. He leaned forward and placed a firm hand on the shoulder of the acolyte behind the wheel.
"Pull over here, please."
Valdespino turned, surprised.
"We're almost..."
"I want to know what's going on,"
the prince barked, his voice loud inside the small car.
"Don Julian, tonight has been tumultuous, but you must..."
"I must trust you?" Julian demanded.
"Yes."
Julian squeezed the shoulder of the young driver and pointed to a grassy shoulder on the deserted country road.
"Pull over," he ordered sharply.
"Keep going," Valdespino countered. "Don Julian, I'll explain."
"Stop the car,"
the prince bellowed. The acolyte swerved onto the shoulder, skidding to a stop on the grass.
"Give us some privacy, please," Julian ordered, his heart beating fast.
The acolyte did not need to be told twice. He leaped out of the idling car and hurried off into the darkness, leaving Valdespino and Julian alone in the back seat. In the pale moonlight, Valdespino looked suddenly frightened.
"You should be scared," Julian said in a voice so authoritative that it startled even himself.
Valdespino pulled back, looking stunned by the threatening tone, one that Julian had never before used with the bishop.
"I am the future king of Spain," Julian said. "Tonight you've removed my security detail, denied me access to my phone and my staff, prohibited me from hearing any news, and refused to let me contact my fiancée."
"I truly apologize," Valdespino began.
"You'll have to do better than that,"
Julian interrupted, glaring at the bishop, who looked strangely small to him now. Valdespino drew a slow breath and turned to face Julian in the darkness.
"I was contacted earlier tonight, Don Julian, and told to..."
"Contacted by whom?"
The bishop hesitated.
"By your father. He is deeply upset."
"He is?"
Julian had visited his father only 2 days ago at Palacio de la Zarzuela and found him in excellent spirits, despite his deteriorating health.
"Why is he upset?"
"Unfortunately, he saw the broadcast by Edmund Kirsch."
Julian felt his jaw tighten. His ailing father slept almost 24 hours a day and should never have been awake at that hour. Furthermore, the king had always forbidden televisions and computers in palace bedrooms, which he insisted were sanctuaries reserved for sleeping and reading, and the king's nurses would have known enough to prevent him from trying to get out of bed to watch an atheist's publicity stunt.
"It was my fault," Valdespino said. "I gave him a computer tablet a few weeks ago, so he wouldn't feel so isolated from the world. He was learning to text and email. He ended up seeing Kirsch's event on his tablet."
Julian felt ill to think of his father, possibly in the final weeks of his life, watching a divisive anti-Catholic broadcast that had erupted in bloody violence. The king should have been reflecting on the many extraordinary things he had accomplished for his country.
"As you can imagine," Valdespino went on, regaining his composure, "his concerns were many.
but he was particularly upset by the tenor of Kirsch's remarks and your fiancé's willingness to host the event. The king felt the involvement of the future queen reflected very poorly on you and on the palace.
Umbra is her own woman. My father knows that.
Be that as it may, when he called, he was as lucid and angry as I've heard him in years. He ordered me to bring you to him at once.
Then why are we here? Julian demanded, motioning ahead to the driveway of the casita. He's at Zarzuela.
Not anymore, Valdespino said quietly. He ordered his aides and nurses to dress him, put him in a wheelchair, and take him to another location, so he could spend his final days surrounded by his country's history. As the bishop spoke those words, Julian realized the truth. La Casita was never our destination. Tremulous, Julian turned away from the bishop, gazing past the casita's driveway down the country road that stretched out before them. In the distance, through the trees, he could just make out the illuminated spires of a colossal building. El Escorial. Less than a mile away, standing like a fortress at the base of Mount Abantos, was one of the largest religious structures in the world, Spain's fabled El Escorial. With more than 8 acres of floor space, the complex housed a monastery, a basilica, a royal palace, a museum, a library, and a series of the most frightening death chambers Julian had ever seen. The Royal Crypt. Julian's father had brought him to the crypt when Julian was only 8 years old, guiding the boy through the Panteón de Infantes, a warren of burial chambers that overflowed with the tombs of royal children. Julian would never forget seeing the crypt's horrifying birthday cake tomb, a massive round sepulchre that resembled a white layer cake and contained the remains of 60 royal children, all of whom had been placed in drawers and slid into the sides of the cake for all eternity. Julian's horror at the sight of this grisly tomb had been eclipsed minutes later when his father took him to see his mother's final resting place. Julian had expected to see a marble tomb fit for a queen, but instead his mother's body lay in a startlingly plain leaden box in a bare stone room at the end of a long hallway. The king explained to Julian that his mother was currently buried in a pudridero, a decaying chamber, where royal corpses were entombed for 30 years until nothing but dust remained of their flesh, at which time they were relocated to their permanent sepulchres. Julian remembered needing all of his strength to fight back tears and the urge to be sick. Next, his father took him to the top of a steep staircase that seemed to descend forever into the subterranean darkness. Here, the walls and stairs were no longer white marble, but rather a majestic amber color. On every third step, votive candles cast flickering light on the tawny stone. Young Julian reached up and grasped the ancient rope railing, descending with his father one stair at a time, deep into the darkness. At the bottom of the stairs, the king opened an ornate door and stepped aside, motioning for young Julian to enter. The Pantheon of Kings, his father told him. Even at 8, Julian had heard of this room, a place of legends. Trembling, the boy stepped over the threshold and found himself in a resplendent ochre chamber. Shaped like an octagon, the room smelled of incense and seemed to waver in and out of focus in the uneven light of the candles that burned in the overhead chandelier. Julian moved to the center of the room, turning slowly in place, feeling cold and small in the solemn space. All 8 walls contained deep niches, where identical black coffins were stacked from floor to ceiling, each with a golden nameplate. The names on the coffins were from the pages of Julian's history books. King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella, King Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor. In the silence, Julian could feel the weight of his father's loving hand on his shoulder, and the gravity of the moment struck him. One day my father will be buried in this very room. Without a word, father and son climbed out of the earth, away from death, and back into the light. Once they were outside in the blazing Spanish sun, the king crouched down and looked 8-year-old Julian in the eye.
"Memento mori," the monarch whispered. "Remember death. Even for those who wield great power, life is brief. There's only one way to triumph over death, and that is by making our lives masterpieces. We must seize every opportunity to show kindness and to love fully. I see in your eyes that you have your mother's generous soul. Your conscience will be your guide. When life is dark, let your heart show you the way."
Decades later, Julian needed no reminders that he had done precious little to make his life a masterpiece. In fact, he had barely managed to escape the king's shadow and establish himself as his own man.
"I've disappointed my father in every way."
For years, Julian had followed his father's advice and let his heart show the way. But it was a tortuous road when his heart longed for a Spain so utterly contrary to that of his father. Julian's dreams for his beloved country were so bold that they could never be uttered until his father's death, and even then Julian had no idea how his actions would be received, not only by the royal palace, but by the entire nation. All Julian could do was wait, keep an open heart, and respect tradition. And then, 3 months ago, everything had changed. I met Ambra Vidal. The vivacious, strong-minded beauty had turned Julian's world upside down. Within days of their first meeting, Julian finally understood the words of his father. "Let your heart show you the way, and seize every opportunity to love fully." The elation of falling in love was like nothing Julian had ever experienced, and he sensed he might finally be taking his very first steps towards making his life a masterpiece. Now, however, as the prince stared blankly down the road ahead, he was overcome by a foreboding sense of loneliness and isolation. His father was dying, the woman he loved was not speaking to him, and he had just admonished his trusted mentor, Bishop Valdespino.
"Prince Julian," the bishop urged gently, "we should go. Your father is frail, and he is eager to speak to you."
Julian turned slowly to his father's lifelong friend.
"How much time do you think he has?" he whispered.
Valdespino's voice trembled as if he were on the verge of tears.
"He asked me not to worry you, but I sense the end is coming faster than anyone anticipated. He wants to say goodbye."
"Why didn't you tell me where we were going?" Julian asked. "Why all the lies and secrecy?"
"I'm sorry. I had no choice. Your father gave me explicit orders. He ordered me to insulate you from the outside world and from the news until he had a chance to speak to you personally."
"Insulate me from what news?"
"I think it will be best if you let your father explain."
Julian studied the bishop a long moment.
"Before I see him, there is something I need to know. Is he lucid? Is he rational?"
Valdespino gave him an uncertain look.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because," Julian replied, "his demands tonight seem strange and impulsive."
Valdespino nodded sadly.
"Impulsive or not, your father is still the king.
I love him, and I do as he commands. We all do.
Chapter 73. Standing side by side at the display case, Robert Langdon and Ambre Vidal peered down at the William Blake manuscript illuminated by the soft glow of the oil lamp. Father Benya had wandered off to straighten up a few pews, politely giving them some privacy. Langdon was having trouble reading the tiny letters in the poem's handwritten text, but the larger header at the top of the page was perfectly legible. The Four Zoas. Seeing the words, Langdon instantly felt a ray of hope. The Four Zoas was the title of one of Blake's best-known prophetic poems, a massive work that was divided into 9 nights, or chapters. The poem's themes, as Langdon recalled from his college reading, centered on the demise of conventional religion and the eventual dominance of science. Langdon scanned down the stanzas of text, seeing the handwritten lines come to an end halfway down the page at an elegantly sketched finis divisionem, the graphic equivalent of the end. This is the last page of the poem, he realized, the finale of one of Blake's prophetic masterpieces. Langdon leaned in and squinted at the tiny handwriting, but he couldn't quite read the text in the dim lantern light. Ambra was already crouched down, her face an inch from the glass. She quietly skimmed the poem, pausing to read one of the lines out loud.
And man walks forth from midst of the fires. The evil is all consumed.
She turned to Langdon.
The evil is all consumed?
Langdon considered it, nodding vaguely. I believe Blake is referring to the eradication of corrupt religion. A religionless future was one of his recurring prophecies. Ambro looked hopeful.
Edmund said his favorite line of poetry was a prophecy that he hoped would come true.
Well, Langdon said, a future without religion is certainly something Edmund wanted. How many letters in that line? Ambra began counting but shook her head.
Over 50.
She returned to skimming the poem, pausing a moment later.
How about this one? The expanding eyes of man behold the depths of wondrous worlds.
Possible, Langdon said, pondering its meaning. Human intellect will continue to grow and evolve over time, enabling us to see more deeply into the truth.
Too many letters again, Ambra said. I'll keep going.
As she continued down the page, Langdon began pacing pensively behind her. The lines she'd already read echoed in his mind and conjured a distant memory of his reading Blake in a Princeton Brit Lit class. Images began forming, as sometimes happened with Langdon's eidetic memory. These images conjured new images, in endless succession. Suddenly, standing in the crypt, Langdon flashed on his professor, who, upon the class's completion of the Four Zoas, stood before them and asked the age-old questions. Which would you choose? A world without religion, or a world without science? Then the professor had added, clearly William Blake had a preference, and nowhere is his hope for the future better summarized than in the final line of this epic poem. Langdon drew a startled breath and spun toward Ambra, who was still poring over Blake's text. Ambra, skip down to the end of the poem, he said, now recalling the poem's final line. Ambra looked to the end of the poem. After focusing a moment, she turned back to him with an expression of wide-eyed disbelief. Langdon joined her at the book, peering down at the text. Now that he knew the line, he was able to make out the faint, handwritten letters. The dark religions are departed, and sweet science reigns.
The dark religions are departed, Amber read aloud, and sweet science reigns.
The line was not only a prophecy that Edmund would endorse, it was essentially a synopsis of his presentation earlier tonight. Religions will fade, and science will rule. Ambra began carefully counting the letters in the line, but Langdon knew it was unnecessary. This is it, No doubt. His mind had already turned to accessing Winston and launching Edmund's presentation. Langdon's plan for how to make that happen was something he would need to explain to Ambre in private. He turned to Father Benya, who was just returning. "Father," he asked, "we're almost done here. Would you mind going upstairs and telling the Guardia agents to summon the helicopter? We'll need to leave at once."
"Of course," Benya said, and headed up the stairs. "I hope you found what you came for. I'll see you upstairs in a moment."
As the priest disappeared up the stairs, Ambra turned away from the book with a look of sudden alarm.
"Robert," she said, "this line is too short. I counted it twice. It's only 46 letters. We need 47.
"What?" Langdon walked over to her, squinting at the text and carefully counting each handwritten letter. "The dark religions are departed and sweet science reigns." Sure enough, he had arrived at 46. Baffled, he studied the line again. "Edmund definitely said 47, not 46?
"Absolutely."
Langdon reread the line. "But this must be it," he thought.
"What am I missing?"
Carefully, he scanned every letter in the final line of Blake's poem. He was almost to the end when he saw it. "And sweet science reigns." "The ampersand," Langdon blurted, "the symbol Blake used instead of writing out the word and." Ambra eyed him strangely and then shook her head.
"Robert, if we substitute the word and, then the line has 48 letters. Too many."
"Not true," Langdon smiled. "It's a code within a code." Langdon marveled at Edmund's cunning little twist. The paranoid genius had used a simple typographic trick to ensure that even if someone discovered which line of poetry was his favorite, they would still not be able to type it correctly. "The ampersand code," Langdon thought. Edmund remembered it. The origin of the ampersand was always one of the first things Langdon taught his symbology classes. The symbol and was a logogram, literally a picture representing a word. While many people assumed the symbol derived from the English word and, it actually derived from the Latin word et. The ampersand's unusual design was a typographical fusion of the letters E and T, the ligature still visible today in computer fonts like Trebuchet, whose ampersand ET clearly echoed its Latin origin. Langdon would never forget that the week after he had taught Edmund's class about the ampersand, the young genius had shown up wearing a T-shirt printed with the message, "Ampersand, phone home," a playful allusion to the Spielberg movie about an extraterrestrial named E.T. who was trying to find his way home. Now, standing over Blake's poem, Langdon was able to picture Edmund's 47-letter password perfectly in his mind. "The dark religions are departed, et sweet science reigns." Quintessential Edmund, Langdon thought, quickly sharing with Ambra the clever trick Edmund had used to add a level of security to his password. As the truth dawned on her, Ambra began smiling as broadly as Langdon had seen her smile since they met.
"Well," she said, "I guess if we ever had any doubts that Edmund Kirsch was a geek."
The two of them laughed together, taking the moment to exhale in the solitude of the crypt.
"You found the password," she said, sounding grateful, "and I feel sorrier than ever that I lost Edmund's phone. If we still had it, we could trigger Edmund's presentation right now."
"Not your fault," he said reassuringly, "and as I told you, I know how to find Winston. At least, I think I do," he mused, hoping he was right. As Langdon pictured the aerial view of Barcelona and the unusual puzzle that lay ahead, the silence of the crypt was shattered by a jarring sound echoing down the stairwell. Upstairs, Father Benya was screaming and calling their names. Chapter 74.
"Hurry, Miss Vidal, Professor Langdon,
Come up here quickly.
Langdon and Ambra bounded up the crypt stairs as Father Benya's desperate shouts continued. When they reached the